and welcome to Worlds Apart. Ukraine's recent drone attack deep into Russia's territory has been praised in the West for its ingenuity and logistics, but it makes the prospect of a peace settlement even more elusive than before. With part of Russia's nuclear triad being struck, something that was off limits even during the height of the Cold War, is there still any point in trying to bring the warring sides to the negotiating table? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeff Reach, historian and a former Australian government official. Mr. Reach, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me at this very tense time.
Now, speaking about tense times, over the last couple of days, I've heard a couple of my friends and acquaintances in the UK, in Poland, in the United States express concern about Russia's potential use of nuclear weapons to retaliate for the Ukrainian attacks. They seem to be very worried, in fact, about the impending start of World War III. And yet, politicians and officials in those very countries seem to be quite jubilant, if not ecstatic, over this latest escalation. Whose senses do you think are more in tune with reality of what's going on?
Well, it is very, very disturbing. I mean, I haven't heard a lot of discussion of the idea of a potential nuclear strike from Russia, but I have heard people speculate on the possible use of the Arestnik missiles and that kind of thing. But certainly the initial reaction from Russia seems to be, relatively prudent, I guess, without over escalating the situation. But it is a very significant concern, and I guess some of the talk about the audacious attack by Ukraine is pretty inflammatory rhetoric, and it does seem to cross a very important threshold of putting at risk some of the fundamental principles of nuclear deterrence.
Now, one may say that military bases and airports are fair military targets, and yet even during the Cold War, Western military commanders wouldn't authorize an attack like that, not because they didn't have the means, the technical means to carry it out, but because they knew that it would be interpreted as a direct act of war against Russia. Now, the Ukrainians are now jubilant, and I can understand, part of me at least, can understand their jubilation, but do you think it's wise for Western officials, or particularly for the European politicians, to try to associate themselves with the Ukrainian side when it comes to these particular attacks?
I think it is risky in relationship to these attacks, and I've certainly noted, the comments from President Putin about the nature of the terrorist activity that is underway here, and the sponsors of terrorist activity, including Western countries. I mean, there is, I guess, a very narrow pathway towards peace, or at least to the conclusion of this war. And I don't think attacks on nuclear capabilities is really that pathway. I think the pathway is to resume some form of negotiation and some sort of respect for the different objectives and interests of all the different parties, Europe, Ukraine, the United States, Britain, and of course, Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ukrainian President Zelensky has already been using these attacks as part of his fundraising campaign in Europe. He's been asking for more funds, for more weapons. If you were in Russia's shoes, how would you go about assessing what is a proportional response? I mean, should it target just Ukraine, or, as you said, its sponsors and abettors in the West too?
I think the key thing probably to bear in mind is to achieve the political objectives for Russia. I mean, for any party to the war, I guess their use of military force at this point ought to be seeking to achieve their political objectives, which I think for all the parties at this point is also to come to some sort of conclusion in the new conditions of this war. So certainly in relationship to the United States, I would have thought it would be, well, certainly in relationship to the United States, they've signaled they want to bring the war to an end, and I think they ought to control their allies in Ukraine, Britain, and the European Union to not do things that aggravate or prevent the conclusion of the war. And I think if I were in Russia's shoes, the improbable situation of me being in Russia's shoes, I think I would be making a careful calculation based on your assessment of the decision making, particularly in Washington, of what can return people to a more controlled set of negotiations towards peace.
And I find your point about political motivations very important here, because I think Russia is keenly aware not only of the West or the United States, but also the rest of the world watching. And I think it cares about its reputation in the eyes of, you know, countries big and small around the world that are not directly part to this conflict. Now, speaking about the United States, President Trump said that Washington got no heads up from the Ukrainians about this attack. Are you inclined to believe it? And generally speaking, do you think such actions are usually coordinated among allies?
Well, a BOA reports this operation went over 18 months, involves quite a lot of activity, no doubt would have required use of surveillance assets. I mean, I'm not a kind of a military analyst, strategic analyst in any way, but it certainly seems to be quite a complex and significant operation. And given it is attacking, the nuclear capability of Russia, surely that must have sent a red flag to someone to consult and get some advice on whether it was such a great idea. So, I mean, the United States in particular is a very fragmented government. You know, there's lots of different agencies and lots of people with a little bit of power who can do things within their own control. So it's possible that maybe someone has acted within their own sense of their authority, but I do think it is unlikely that such a major and coordinated attack has not been given some level of senior approval somewhere.
Now, the whole purpose of an alliance is shared liability. This is what NATO is built on. This is what its Article 5 is all about. I wonder if Ukrainian NATO's membership is going to be seen as a more or less attractive opportunity or possibility for NATO members. In other words, would they see that as something potentially dangerous, that Ukraine, you know, can orchestrate an attack like that, possibly drawing them into a major escalation? Or do you think that may be seen as an asset, that the Ukrainians actually can, you know, strike Russia really deep, and it seems quite effectively?
Well, I mean, I just can't imagine that it simply doesn't help collective security in Europe. There may be people who see it that way, but I just cannot see how endorsing this kind of action is in any way beneficial for people in the long term. I mean, in the long term, the European Union, Ukraine, and Russia are all neighbours. They will need to get along, and they will need to find some sort of modus vivendi. It may well be that perhaps if we take Britain, who are quite fond of these kind of intelligence operations, and perhaps, still have quite a few military bases, including in Eastern Europe, if they get out of the equation, it might be a little bit more stable and settled. And certainly if the United States maybe withdraws from its more aggressive ambitions into Eurasia, I think that would also improve things. But ultimately, Europe, Russia, Ukraine, share. Ukraine's the second largest country in Europe after, you know, European Russia, so that they share a common home, and their security is ultimately improved by not fighting each other.
Well, I think you are certainly right in the long term. And yet, in the short term, I think the sparks are very intense. It's already been announced by the Kremlin that response will be coming. And President Putin specifically noted that he believes that the Zelensky regime has fully degenerated into a terrorist organization. Do you think that's just a figurative statement, or do you think Russia is likely to approach this retaliation with a view that it's dealing with terrorists in Kyiv? In other words, do you think it's likely that it will go after the Ukrainian leadership directly?
I really can't judge what those decisions, whether they'll target the leadership directly. I mean, I do. It does seem clear that it's going to be very difficult to find a secure peace with the current government in Kyiv. And I do think that, part of the issue that Russia probably needs to negotiate with the United States is to find a pathway to a more reliable negotiation partner in Ukraine that has a genuine interest in resolving the war.
Okay. Now, I do want to ask you a question about terrorism, because the Western war on terror seems to have produced far more casualties than the terror itself. And part of it is due to, disproportionate response. And also, hiding behind this collateral damage euphemism that led to a lot of civilian casualties. And yet, at least until the Ukrainian war, it was considered that, it's not okay to channel your hostility towards a political regime onto people, ordinary people. Is it just me, or do you think there is a justified impression that attitudes towards the use of terrorism for political purposes are becoming somewhat lenient in the West?
Questions have been raised about, the situation in Syria in that regard too, haven't there? More broadly, I personally, I can't speak for my country or anything like that, but I certainly have personally found some of the kinds of actions that have been accepted or celebrated even in Western politics over the last few years, including, the sort of extreme ethno-nationalism, use of neo-Nazi symbols, celebration of Stefan Bandera, et cetera, in Ukraine, really quite troubling. And there has been an uneasy marriage between West and some of these really quite noxious sort of ideologies, which I think is very, very troubling.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Rich, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
За одну ночь с 13 на 14 марта здесь погибло больше 1000 человек от тифа, голода и холода. Это и есть начало лагеря смерти Азарыча.
Under the guise of evacuation, about 50,000 people were transported there. The main purpose of this concentration camp in Belarus was to infect prisoners with typhus and use them as a human shield against the advancing Soviet army.
Прибыл из Германии доктор Блюменталь. В общем-то, он привез бациллы с сыпным тифом. И потом их аэрозолью распрыскивали уже над лагерем, когда туда согнали.
Считали, что попростуживались. А потом уже поняли, и немцы сами сказали, что тиф-тиф-тиф. И подписали даже тиф.
The Nazis used people as biological weapons, leaving them to perish without food, water or shelter.
Идешь, смотришь, лежат дети с открытыми глазами. Вот лежит и смотрит никуда.
А уже не живые лежат, а кто и живые еще подняться не могут.
The camp lasted 10 days, but what else made it drastically different from other camps of the Third Reich? Watch on RT.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jeff Reach, historian and former Australian government official. Now, Mr. Reach, you've been quite prolific in analyzing the policies of Western government. Sometimes you've been quite critical of that. And in one of your articles, you analyzed the governance of Barack Obama, whom you called the prince who has who was promised but disappointed and failed. And I wonder if it's not just about the failure of any particular leader, be it Obama or Trump, but rather sort of a larger phenomenon of the West always longing for some kind of prince charming or princess charming, you know, somebody who can be idealized for a little while and then thrown away when things go awry.
Yes, and in that piece about Obama, you know, it was partly about the idea that America is a promised land, and you know, his autobiography about the early part of his presidency was titled "A Promised Land," and so I guess I was making the you know the analogy with the sort of Game of Thrones prophecy that you know there is a savior coming, and that that I guess miracles can be achieved by liberal democratic politics that perhaps are not really reasonable. And that sort of theme sort of runs through Obama's autobiography about his presidency. He comes to question whether he really sort of achieved his ideals. Ultimately, he sort of thinks he does. But there was you know, it was an extraordinary wave of hope, I guess, around the world when Barack Obama was elected. And in many ways, it has been rather deeply disappointed, and not least, I guess, in terms of relationships with Russia.
But, you know, Obama, for all his vanity, was reluctant to get involved in the Libyan campaign. It was France and the United Kingdom who essentially dragged the United States into destroying this, what used to be a fairly well-off and quite prosperous African country, where, by the way, the conflict is simmering to this day, more than a decade later. Do you think the Libyan case in particular has been sort of soaked in the West in terms of understanding what has been done to that country and what the West has gotten in return for interfering there so unceremoniously and, you know, producing nothing good?
Well, I don't really think so. I mean, I certainly remember the Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, being a big advocate of intervention in Libya, and there hasn't really been a reckoning with the utter tragedy that has happened in that country, let alone the tragedy that's happened in Syria, or indeed, you know, the tragedy that's happened for the people of Ukraine in the as a result of the interventions in Ukraine over recent years. And as you say, I feel Obama was perhaps had some more cautious instincts, and he was drawn in by the other parts of the American government, perhaps, rather than really, I guess, consciously setting out to create the events that did actually unfold. But that, unfortunately, it seems to be the common way with the United States. It's certainly been the case in Ukraine, and who knows, it may even be happening in these recent events that we were talking about in the first part of the program with the Operation Spiderweb, you know.
Absolutely. This is actually why I'm posing this question, because I think the Libyan case is absolutely crucial in understanding Russia's actions in Ukraine and Russia's staunch opposition to NATO expansion, precisely because of this recklessness with which, you know, parts of the West or NATO go about destroying the countries that they find disagreeable. Do you think it's likely to change after the war in Ukraine? In other words, has the damage been substantial enough to impress a little bit more caution on our Western neighbors?
Well, I have written quite a bit about Emmanuel Todd, the French historian who's written his book, The Defeat of the West, and who I believe recently visited Russia and gave a speech in Russia about the book as well. And he talks about the defeat of the West now leading on to a shock, the shock of defeat and the shock of the realization that, you know, the West doesn't always win. I do think that is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet, so far as I can tell. And I think you see that in a lot of the American commentary, both, you know, pro and anti sort of Trump. There's still a kind of a sense that whatever happens, America is the maker of events rather than the person who is affected by events.
Absolutely. But I think at this point it's mostly rhetorical. It's pretty clear that in terms of, you know, actual presence, the Americans are far more restrained. I mean, in some way they are compensating with louder speeches, but I think in actual deeds, they are far more humble. But we'll see. I do want to ask you about Ukraine and Zelensky in particular. You know, given our earlier discussion about the Western need for the prince, Zelensky seems to fit that description so far. I mean, he's been compared to Winston Churchill and other notable historical figures. Do you think there'll come a point where he'll be found disappointing, not by his own people, but by his sponsors and perhaps shown to the door?
I think that is possible. The way in which he's been idolized in the West has really been quite extraordinary, you know, and quite ubiquitous. It was almost, I don't know, like it's like a mass delusion almost. So I think it's going to be very, very hard for people to accept the disappointment when other facts are revealed about things and ultimately, you know, his time comes to an end. So I think it's possible, but it might also just be like what happened in, you know, Afghanistan in the, I can't remember the leader of Afghanistan at the end of the sort of American sort of war there, who sort of, you know, went
Ashraf off. Ghani,
took the money and flew off, and it never gets mentioned in the Western media ever again, and no one ever quite sort of asks him all the money back.
But, you know, I actually interviewed President Ghani a short while ago, and I can say that he was a very mild-mannered man. Compared to Zelensky, because he doesn't have as much blood on his hands, and he has not contributed to the destruction and the dismemberment of his own country to quite such an extent. So I wonder if, you know, this one-way ticket to the West is still open to him, but I guess time will tell. Now, despite this latest escalation, Russia and Ukraine do seem to be willing to continue with their engagement, as unproductive and superficial as it may appear at this point of time. How do you understand their motivations?
Well, I think there's a very sort of fragile sort of like pontoon bridge, I guess, between war and peace at the moment. And it can't achieve too much, but at least it keeps the channel of communication open. I think I don't really understand the nature of the motivations of the Ukrainian government. My fear, I guess, is at some point it's going to dissolve and collapse, and there'll be a real, you know, like a kind of a social catastrophe there in Ukraine, because it has been, I mean, quite apart from the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, there's been this, you know, de facto civil war, this enormous social conflict, the involvement of all the neo-Nazi ideologies, and, you know, a huge, huge refugee crisis, and if as well as all the you know, the taking people off the streets to conscript them for the war. So there's these deep traumas within Ukrainian society, and I don't see the current Ukrainian government really seeking to do anything particularly apart from continue the war and not sort of acknowledging they've made a terrible, terrible mistake, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But at some point that will crack, and I think Russia has an enormous challenge then, I guess, in terms of working out how to govern this broken society in some way, not necessarily itself, but how to establish some form of decent government again in Ukraine.
Well, I'm not sure Russia would be up for taking responsibility for the entirety of Ukraine. I think Europe will also have to contribute a little bit. And that leads me to a question about the European Union, because in your writing, you've been very articulate about the need to consider the motivations of all sides involved and to some extent accommodate those motivations. How do you understand the EU's aims at this point of time? What is it after?
Well, again, if I refer to Emmanuel Todd, he refers to he has a sort of chronology of this war going back, you know, to the early 1990s, and talks about the period between 2008 and 2014 as the period of German hubris, where effectively, I mean, to simplify, Germany saw Ukraine as an economic zone or economic colony, you could say, that it could incorporate as you know, there's a significant part of Eastern Europe that is, you know, integrated in with the sort of German industrial economy. And so there were economic ambitions for Europe. The events prior to the Maidan were about the events in 2014 were partly about, you know, an economic agreement with the European Union, where Europe played very, very hard ball with Ukraine, and a lot of the Ukrainians were very disappointed and perhaps then started to turn to the United States for a more military approach to their nationalism rather than a more economic approach. So to some degree, I see Europe's motivations, certainly at the start of the war, as being fundamentally economic, but also partly being a result of Europe's sort of divided state. I mean, the European Union is you know, a difficult political federation, I guess, but it's also, it doesn't really have control of its defence and security policy, because that's really vested in NATO, which means it's really vested in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so there's this tug of war within European political elites between whether they're serving the Atlantic Alliance or the European consensus, I guess. And I think that's part of the fundamental tension for Europe in resolving this war. At some point, I feel they need to think more about European defence rather than American global ambitions. And you know, as a result, I think they might have a different approach to both Ukraine and to Russia.
Well, Mr. Rich, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.